Big congratulations this week to Colson Whitehead. He just won the National Book Award for his sweeping epic novel, The Underground Railroad. It's a story that draws connections between America's past and its present. Whitehead reimagines the Underground Railroad as an actual train system, complete with locomotives and conductors. So it's partly an alternative history. The characters include a girl named Cora, who grows up enslaved on a plantation in Georgia. Her friend Caesar urges her to escape, so Cora heads north, with slave catchers on her heels, looking for that Underground Railroad. Steve Paulson sat down to talk with Colson Whitehead recently, and he asked him to begin with a reading from the book.
The first time Caesar approached Cora about running north, she said no. This was her grandmother talking. Cora's grandmother had never seen the ocean before that bright afternoon in the port of Ouida, and the water dazzled after her time in the fort's dungeon. The dungeon stored them until the ships arrived. Dahomian raiders kidnapped the men first, then returned to her village the next moon for the women and children, marching them in chains to the sea, two by two. The survivors from her village told her that when her father couldn't keep up the pace of the long march, the slavers stove in his head and left his body by the trail. Cora's grandmother was sold a few times on the trek to the fort, passed between slavers for cowrie shells and glass beads. It was hard to say how much they paid for her in Ouida, as she was part of a bulk purchase. 88 human souls for 60 crates of rum and gunpowder. Able-bodied men and childbearing women fetched more than juveniles. This was the ship's final port of call before they crossed the Atlantic. Two yellow-haired sailors rowed Ajari out to the ship, humming, white skin like bone.
So Cora, your main character, is a third-generation slave, and until she escapes when she's 15, she has never known any kind of life except that brutal life on the plantation that she's lived on. How would you describe her?
She's being described to me as a badass, so, which I find endearing. But yeah, you know, her mother, Mabel, has run away years before, and she exists on the plantation as a stray, someone with no family, and forced to fend for herself. You know, it takes a unique personality to contemplate being able to leave the plantation, a certain kind of bravery and strength that I'm not sure I would have had if I was in her place 150 years ago. So, you know, just being able to run from the plantation and aim herself north towards the moon, she's a formidable personality.
And so this becomes a story of how Cora starts to gain some control over her own life. I mean, some sense of agency when she's had none. But just as she's sort of developing this internal power, the forces all around her are closing in. I mean, of course, there is the racism of the 19th century, and especially the slave catchers who are chasing after her.
Sure. I mean, you know, I think a story of an escape from plantation is already an adventure story. In this case, you know, I've come up with a different culture for every state that she moves through as she moves north. So North Carolina has a personality, South Carolina, Georgia.
What was the idea for that, that you sort of created these fictional cultures for each state?
Well, you know, I had the idea to explore what if the Underground Railroad was an actual railroad, that sort of childish idea you have before you figure out how things work. And that's a premise, not much of a story. So to complicate it, I followed the example of Gulliver's Travels, where each sort of state is a new island where we can see a different aspect of America explored. And, you know, I had this idea many years ago, and I came up with a white supremacist state, a black separatist state, a state where slaves are freed and given jobs and housing and education. And these different cultures allow me to critique different aspects of American history and talk about the changing concept of race in America.
So you've created your own alternative history. I mean, obviously, you're very familiar with the real history of 19th century slavery, but you're tweaking it all over the place. Is that so you can sort of play with ideas in a more creative way?
Sure. I mean, you know, my idea was I was not going to stick to the facts, but I would stick to the truth. And so what is slavery about? You know, I think once I made the decision to make a literal train, I was free from, you know, a certain burden of realism. And I could mix and match different episodes from American history to tell a different story than the one America sort of tells itself.
I would think writing about the slave experience would be awfully intimidating because, I mean, there has been so much written about slavery, so much good writing, I mean, both fiction and history. Did you sort of wonder, could you say anything new? I mean, figure out a way into this?
Well, you know, that's always a problem. Sometimes when I work on a book, I want to go see how other people approach it. Sometimes I don't. But this time, you know, I hadn't read Beloved by Toni Morrison in like 25 years or The Known World by Edward Jones in 12 years. And so I was like, oh, I'll see how they do it. And so, of course, I read 30 pages of Beloved and was like, oh, I'm totally screwed. Like, you can't beat Toni Morrison, you know.
She's already done this.
So, but no matter what you're writing about, whether it's war or family or race, in all likelihood, someone smarter and more talented than you has done it before. So all you can do is trust that you have something new to say, something unique from your perspective.
So was it these elements of fantasy that you brought in? I mean, the counterfactual pieces of history and sort of playing with bits of more recent history that you incorporated into your story. Was that the way to make it fresh?
It's not the way I thought about it, but it was my first thought on how to elaborate on the premise of a literal railroad and I stuck with it. I grew up as someone who didn't like to leave the house, and I always watched The Twilight Zone and Star Trek and read a lot of horror. And the people whose work I responded to when I first started reading were people who talked about the world through the filter of fantasy. You know, by tweaking, by adopting different perspective, we can see the world in a different way. So for me, it seems like a natural tool of storytelling. Sometimes you want to be realistic, and sometimes, you know, maybe coming at something sideways is the way to go.
There's one thing I have to ask you about. You have these great scenes in your alternative history. In South Carolina, after Cora's escape, she takes a job in a place called the Museum of Natural Wonders, where there's a section in the museum called Living History, and she's supposed to enact the life of a slave. There's one exhibit called Scenes from Darkest Africa. Another one is called Life on the Slave Ship. And I mean, this is totally sanitized a view of history where slaves sew with spinning wheels on the ships coming over to America, of course, all on display for the white visitors to the museum. Where'd you get this idea?
You know, a lot of the more absurd moments in the book are inspired by real life. And so at the great world's fairs in the 1800s, African Americans were put into so-called jungle garb and supposed to act like jungle natives for the audience, for people who would come and see. And that was this sort of fake representation of the Dark Continent.
It was like a zoo, basically, except for there were actual human beings there.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, it sounds absurd, but that's how it actually happened. And as a writer, I'm trying to figure out ways for Cora to interact with history and how fake the white version of history is and how her own experience can actually provide a more true account of how the world works.
Well, I'd love to get a taste of this piece of your novel. And there's a moment where Cora finally decides to kind of fight back in her own way. Could you read that?
Certainly. One day she decided to retaliate against a red-haired white woman who scowled at the sight of Cora's duty on the ship. Cora didn't know the source of her animus or care. The woman irked her. Cora stared into her eyes, unwavering and fierce, until the woman broke, fairly running from the glass towards the agricultural section. From then on, Cora selected one patron per hour to evil eye. A young clerk ducking out from his office in the Griffin Building, a man of enterprise. A harried matron corralling an unruly clutch of children. One of the sour youths who liked to batter the glass and startle Cora. Sometimes this one, sometimes that one. She picked the weak links out of the crowd, the ones who broke under her gaze. The weak link. She liked the ring of it. The people she chose, young and old, from the rich part of town or the more modest streets, did not individually persecute Cora. As a community, they were shackles. If she kept at it, chipping away at the weak links wherever she found them, it might add up to something. She got good at her evil eye. They always broke, the people, not expecting this weird attack. It was a fine lesson, Cora thought, to learn that the slave, the African in your midst, is looking at you too.
Now that is such a great passage. In my reading of this part of your book, and really sort of a through line throughout the whole book, is you're partly commenting on how the history of slavery has been sanitized throughout our own culture in books and movies. Because to truly show how violent, how dehumanizing it was, it's almost unbearable to see.
Well, I mean, who wants to think about it, you know, white or black? I think if you are from the South and your great-great-great-grandfather had slaves, do you want to contemplate the tortures, brutality, rapes, and abuse that he perpetrated upon his property? If you were third-generation college African-American, your family has risen into the middle class, achieved the American dream, do you want to think about what happened 200 years ago? It is terrible to contemplate, and it's uncomfortable. And a lot of the work I'm trying to do in the book is try to make links between what happened 150 years ago and now.
What are some of those links that you see between 150 years ago and now?
You know, we could talk about the assault on the black body. 150 years ago, the police force in the South was the slave patroller. And a slave patroller would roam around plantations. They could enter any free black person's house and demand to see their papers. And if you were caught, you could be brought to jail, beaten. You know, the slave patroller had complete control over any black person they saw. They could stop them. And of course, the echo of that in policing now, you know, is not too hard to discern. I was taught at a young age that, you know, whenever I leave the house, I'm a target, and I can't rely on the police to protect me. I'm immediately viewed as a thug, a villain, and I can be stopped at any time. And, you know, of course, like a lot of people, I've been, you know, stopped in a car for driving while black. I've been handcuffed and interrogated. So, you know, that sort of casual abuse, which can often escalate into lethal abuse, is definitely part of my American experience. And so it's not too hard to find the linkages between the two.
That's Colson Whitehead, who just won the National Book Award for his novel, The Underground Railroad. He was talking with Steve Paulson.